podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Sporticos Football Stories podcast. Today we have the pleasure of hearing from Jim Daly, a stand-up comedian, presenter and the founder of FYP, a Crystal Palace podcast. We get into the fan culture at Selhurst Park, our shared love of Gazzetta Football Italia, Roy Hodgson and much more. So sit back, relax and enjoy our chat with the one and only Jim Daly. Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for coming on today. How are you?
Thanks for having me. Yes, not too bad at all. Thank you. Yes, I'm doing all right.
One of the number one topics that we like to go over on our podcast is the football fan experience at particular clubs. And the best way to start with that, I guess, would be your Crystal Palace origin story. So would you mind, first of all, telling me a little bit about how you fell in love with the game, with the club, all that jazz?
Well, my origin story is, I'd imagine, pretty similar to most people's, in that I was given zero choice by my father when I was about six or five, or just getting into actually, I was a bit of a late bloomer in football. Actually, my dad's been a Palace fan since 1954, I think, so a long time. Seen a lot of things happen at Palace, and he took me to my first game in 1992, so I would have been seven actually at that point. But actually, I was slight late bloomer. I didn't really get into sort of playing football till about 9 or 10, mainly because my younger brother started playing football then, and he was very good at football, which was really annoying. So I thought, well, I'm not going to let him have all the glory. So I started playing as well. But the couple of years later, the 1994 World Cup was in America, was the time I actually genuinely started to fall in love with football. That was the first time I really remember just being awash with all the joy, and it was USA, so it was glitz and glamour, and I really fell in love with the Italian national team and Roberto Baggio. So I spent a few years being obsessed with Italian football. But my Palace story, sorry to go off on a tangent, started with my dad in the early 90s, and I had absolutely zero choice. In fact, he sort of sat me down when I was about six or seven and said, you've got two choices. You can support Palace or you can get the hell out of my house. And it was a tough decision, but the mean streets of Edenbridge, Kent, were a bit too spicy for a 70-year-old. So I chose Palace. So that was it. I had no choice, really. Much like many people, I think it's sort of handed down to you. But I'm glad my dad could have been a Tottenham fan, because his dad was a Tottenham fan. And he took him to Tottenham versus Palace in his first game. My dad actually decided that the red and blue kit was nicer than the white kit, so actually went to Palace. So I could have been, I could be a Spurs fan right now. I don't know if that's actually better or worse, but Palace it was for me because of my dad. And I still watch Palace with my dad now. We have season tickets together in the main stand, so it's nice we've shared this whole sort of journey together.
Oh, wow. How old is your dad now?
He is 76.
Oh, wow. Still going strong. Okay, well, you're right to say that a lot of people's origin stories are similar to that. Not always the case, especially when we speak to more international fans. But yeah, it's a common one. But it's funny that you mentioned the USA World Cup, because I was four when that happened. So I wasn't exactly, it wasn't like my first World Cup that was happening live that I fell in love with. That would have been more 98 and probably Euro 96, actually. But that World Cup actually is probably the oldest tournament that I really, really gravitated to, because I had a VHS of all the goals of USA 94.
Oh, I might have done as well. Yeah.
It's one of my oldest memories is watching that. I remember Lordan Lechkov from Bulgaria. I was obsessed with him. And Stoichkov, I think they went quite far. They got to like the semis, the quarters.
So. Yeah.
And I vividly remember the, I think it was it Italy-Brazil final with Dunga?
Yeah.
I'm with you. That was a huge
terrible
tournament
final. But yeah, and then I fell in love with Baggio, because I mean, he single-handedly took Italy to the final, and his whole story as well with the national team is very interesting as well, and the sort of the highs and lows of that. But there was something about him. I'm so obsessed with Baggio. I've actually got on my desk. I don't think that's going to be in the little.
Is it a bobblehead?
The bobblehead, not quite bobble, but it's the little footballer head things. And I got one of Baggio in his Brescia kit from later on in his career. I've actually got a whole host of them here on my desk. I've got a Del Piero one as well, because I then became a Del Piero fan when Baggio left Juve to go to AC Milan. And
I guess you were a Gazzetta Football Italia watcher as well then.
Massive. I was obsessed with it. Absolutely. To the point where one morning, my best friend at primary school, John, he and his brother and his dad were driving to France for the day, and I said, I'll come with you. That'd be great. And then it got to Saturday morning, and I'd forgotten that I was going to miss Gazzetta Football Italia. And even though I taped every single episode to then watch back over the weekend and the next week, I was so stressed about watching it live, I didn't go, and I had a whole meltdown on my front porch. And in the end, I didn't go. And John and his dad were like, "You want to go because you want to watch James Richardson talk about..." Yeah, but yes. And Peter Brackley. This is important to me. And I never went to France that day. But I'm sure I got to watch Del Piero smash a few in instead.
God, it's so crazy how different the fun experience is now, because like you missed a great day trip or longer to France to watch a pre-taped highlight show. It's not even like a live match or anything. And you could have easily watched it the next day, but you were that dedicated to watching Gazzetta Football Italia in real time.
And who knows where my life would have gone if I'd gone to France. You know, I could have fallen in love with the French culture. I could have studied French at university. I could be living in France right now. Who knows? That one butterfly effect. But I'm happy. I got to watch Gazzetta and still be in love with Italian football. So I'll stick with my decision.
Do you remember, were you there for the David Beckham halfway line thing? I bet you get asked that all the time, but that was at Selhurst Park, wasn't it?
It was, but it was against Wimbledon.
Okay. So, oh, yeah, of course. So, yeah, you wouldn't have been there.
My cousin, who is, and I've got Irish Catholic family, I've got 25 first cousins, and one of them, Maliki, is a big Wimbledon fan. He and his two brothers and two sisters and dad, they're all now they're AFC fans, but they were back then, they were Wimbledon fans, and he was at that game, but he missed the goal because that goal was the last kick of the game. They were already like 2-0 up or something, and it was the last, and hence why you would attempt that, you know, last kick of the game, winning easily. And he was reading the programme, and he sat, wasn't behind the goal because the away fans at that point were behind the goal, but I think he was on the Arthur Waite stand, which is like next to it, so at that end of the ground. And he was reading his programme, and all he heard was saying, "Oh, wow!" And everyone behind him, even though the Wimbledon fans, are going, "Oh my God, what a goal!" And he looks up, it's like, "What?" And they're like, "Beckham's just scored on the halfway line." And he was reading about the reserves' latest match or whatever it was.
Oh my God.
I mean, that is bad. Being there and missing it, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, that is tough. I mean, it's bad enough when you miss like a historic moment like that, when you go to get a beer or go to the toilet just before halftime, or you leave to beat the traffic or whatever. But he was literally there in front of it.
He could have just moved his head a few degrees. And he would have. But having said that, I've done similar. I was at Selhurst once when we played Portsmouth in about 2002, and Dougie Friedman's our striker, now our director of football. And he scored an amazing goal where he took it from maybe halfway inside his own half, dribbled past a few players, and then in the box, there's an amazing sort of chop onto his left foot, beat two men and curled it in the top corner. But we just had our new Jumbotron installed, and I was down the other end of the homestead, and so I was watching it on the Jumbotron, and I couldn't, because I was so like amazed by this new technology, and also the goal was so good, I couldn't take my eyes off it. So I watched the whole goal on the Jumbotron, even though, again, if I'd lowered my head by a few degrees, I'd have watched it live. Then I could have watched the replay on the Jumbotron. So I actually missed one of Friedman's greatest ever goals because I was just taken in by the fact that Palace had this new technology. So that's one. It's not quite as bad as Beckham's, but it's similar.
So you've been knocking around Selhurst Park since the 90s. Selhurst Park, for the rest of us, the neutrals, has a special reputation, I think, as being, you know, one of the better grounds in the country, I think, especially in the Premier League. What would you say makes the atmosphere so special at Selhurst Park right now? And has it always been like that, or has it changed over the years?
My memory from the 90s is we were a very different club. We were a yo-yo team. So I think there was certainly more to get behind in terms of you're either fighting promotion or relegation. So there's more of a sort of anxiety and tenseness in the ground, which I think often does lead to better atmosphere sometimes because there's something to cheer for. And we went to administration twice in the 90s and then 2000s. And certainly in the 90s, we came very close to going out of business. We had a whole season with no money in administration. And that actually was one of my favourite seasons because there was a real collectiveness with the fans and the team. And it felt like we really could cheer them on and every single point was vital. We actually stayed up that season and then we got bought out. But since the mid-2000s, the Homestead Fanatics, who are sort of a European ultras group behind the goal, took it on themselves to improve the atmosphere. And they've done a lot of really good stuff, actually, in terms of the TIFO displays and the banners and a sort of ripple effect that when they are chanting, it does go around the ground. I wouldn't say we got I think in pockets, we have the best atmosphere, certainly behind that goal. Where I sit with my dad is the main stand, which is sort of known as the old fogies stand, which is. And so it's not quite as raucous there. There was a group in the Arthur Waite, which is the stand the other side of us, the stand where the TV cameras are, that's near the Homesdale, they tried to get a little thing going with the Homesdale once, and it kind of worked. So there is a sort of desire there to get it done. I do think that all grounds like Selhurst, which are these sort of old square boxy style grounds where you're quite close to the pitch, I think do make for better atmospheres, because just the design of them means that you're closer to the action. So it's kind of easier to sort of get involved. Unfortunately, although they are beautiful stadiums, the newer bowl shaped ones, I think take people away from the action a little bit. I'm thinking about sort of Southampton, St Mary's, those kind of grounds, even the Emirates when it first started, although the fans there have made a real conscious effort in the last year or so to improve it. And actually, obviously we got hammered, because we always get hammered at the Emirates, but I went to the 5-0 recently, and the Arsenal fans were a lot better. But I think if you're a team outside the top six or seven, a team like Palace, you're nearly, and we're in a weird situation where we've been an established, in quote marks, Premier League team now for probably 8 or 9 years, with little to really play for, a few relegation scraps, but nothing really, no European football. I do think that sanitises the atmosphere a little bit, because you're turning up not too stressed. And in fact, the year before last, when we had Vieira, or his first season 3 years ago, it's the most relaxed I've ever been at Selhurst. I never went to a game thinking we'd get hammered. We never did. If we went behind, we normally came back. We finished mid-table, had a cup run to the semis. It was great. When you're a team that's, and I'm thinking about the teams that may go up and down now, more like Norwich and Burnley and teams like that, there's always something to fight for. So I think that actually gives you a bit more of a impetus to have an atmosphere. But I would say the Homesdale fanatics have done a lot. And they do sometimes rub people up the wrong way. And there currently is a bit of a sort of politics between them and the club going on. But I think they have sparked a fuel inside of a lot of maybe older fans like me, who, when I was a kid, I sat in the Homesdale and I wanted to chant. And I remember I left my dad. He had a season ticket with his mate Leonard in their family stands. And midway through the season, I moved to the Homesdale because I could hear the sweary, naughty chants. And I was like, I want to be involved in that. And I was 16, 17. But as you get older, that energy dissipates. You have kids, that energy flows out of you. And by the time you got to Selhurst at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, you got nothing left. But I do think there's a desire inside most fans to have that. And the Homesdale fanatics do help fuel that a little bit, I think. But I do think, anyway, so back to your original question, that does come back, I think, to the sort of boxy shape of the grounds, as opposed to the kind of bowl shape of the newer ones.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something that you hear a lot from. I remember when West Ham first moved into London Stadium, their fans talked a lot about that. It seems like they've worked really hard to try and turn that around as well. And from what I can tell, it's working in places. But I wanted to move on to your work on FYP. As one of the hosts of the podcast, could you tell me a little bit about what you guys do and how it's grown over the years?
Yeah, so we are the, I don't think it's unfair to call us the number one Crystal Palace fans podcast. I feel a little bit egotistical, but I mean, I think we are, by virtue of being the longest. We've been around for a long time, since 2008. So what's that, 16 years. And we started as a fanzine originally. I created a fanzine at university by the same name. And then around the late 2000s, before podcasts are really a thing, but inspired by the Guardian's World Cup podcast of 2 years previously, I thought I'd try it with FYP. And it turns out there was a desire for it amongst the fans. So we kept going, and we've grown, certainly in the last 5 years, we've got a lot bigger. We've moved platform hosts, and we've really put a lot more effort into regular content, with our key angle, I think, being the quality. I think we try and keep the quality as high as possible in terms of the people that host it. I'm not saying that sounds really, not just me, but like we have lots of other people that host it as well. And the guests we come on are really well informed. We've got Dominic Fifield is one of the best Crystal Palace journalists in the country. We've got a guy called Adam Sells, who produces goalie gloves for a lot of the Premier League, including Palace's goalkeepers, and used to coach at the club. So we're talking about really informed, insightful people. And that's really grown organically over the last 5, 6, 7 years. My background's in journalism, and then sort of later comedy and entertainment and broadcasting. So I've actually learned a lot of skills through doing FYP, but about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided to try and do FYP full time. So I put a lot more effort into the scheduling and the equipment and all that kind of stuff. And I think it took us to the next level. And now we're able to, well, now we have a bar to sort of hit. And actually, I think that attracted then the people that I, because I wanted to expand the hosting, because I've just passed my 500th episode as host. And objectively, that's enough episodes. I mean, when the Proclaimers thought, like, what's the longest distance we could walk to fall in love with, they chose 500. And so
that's the most they could think of.
That is, it's enough of anything, isn't it? So a couple of years ago, I made the decision to try and broaden our hosting pool. So I got a couple of guys on board called Jack Pearson and Joe Walker, and they were listeners and fans, and they've been absolutely brilliant. So that's, I think that's come from the fact that we've tried to keep the quality high, so it's attracted people that respect that as well. So so yeah, we've, to be honest, we were ahead of the game when it came to podcasts, by some way, really. But then when the podcast boom of about, what, 2014, 2015 happened, we really then had to catch up, I think, a little bit. So that helped us take the quality higher. But it's, at its core, it's a very fun thing to do. You know, we all love talking about Palace, and I've enjoyed talking about Palace for a long time. But I've been conscious of spreading the wealth a little bit recently. So I'm really glad being able to branch out. We've got a very successful patron as well. So we do post-match podcasts as well and live episodes. And it's also been able to afford me a career in broadcasting and entertainment, and allows me to fuel my craving of talking about Palace and also broadcasting. You'll know this, it's a creativity itch that you scratch as well when you're broadcasting and making something tangible, but also allows me the free time to then go and work on my comedy and my content creation and all that kind of stuff as well. So it's been a real blessing, really, that just was born out of a desire to create content around Crystal Palace.
And do you guys still keep the fanzine going, either in like a print form or online?
No, so we haven't. The last issue of that was probably a good 5 years ago. To be honest, I would say that peaked around the time the podcast started, late 2000s. But with the sort of boom of social media, it became harder. Because, I mean, social media, essentially people are saying what they say in fanzines, but just with more immediacy. So we had to really change how the fanzine looked. And then as everyone inevitably got older, and all the guys I do it with are my age, mid to late 30s, people had families and jobs, and it became harder to commit to making a quality fanzine. And we've done a few over the last 5 years, we've done one or two sort of like one-off editions. We are thinking about possibly doing a one-off edition at the start of next season. But it really is much more of an undertaking than it used to be.
So you're mostly focused on the podcast side of things.
Yeah.
Is it audio only or video as well?
Well, I would say that's the one area we're quite behind. We are on mostly audio. I have, in the last 6 months or so, tried to do more video content. Again, the problem with that is just time. And I, in my one of my other job strands of sort of social media, I do a lot of that for other people and other brands. But and FYP could benefit from that big time. And when we have guests on, so we interviewed Roy Hodgson before November and Neil Warnock in January, and I made sure those were recorded, and I've been working on doing cut downs for that. But mostly we are audio. I probably need to do some sort of survey where I sort of ask our listeners, is there a desire for video? We actually did, to be fair, at the weekend for our patrons, we did our first post-match video podcast. So we break our post-match into two. We do a really quick 25-minute immediate one outside the ground, zero analysis, all emotion, and we try and put that up as much as quick as possible. And then we do one the next day with Adam, which is more analytical and sort of less emotional. I recorded that first one on Saturday because I bought some better clip-on mics and a bit more equipment. And actually, the feedback was really good. So we're going to look to try and do that more often. But I would say that we are slightly behind on that. I think there are other podcasts of other clubs that, you know, the Anfield Wrap for Liverpool, for example, does that very, very well in terms of their sort of video versus audio content. But there's definitely plans to improve that. But again, it's just time.
And you mentioned your career in comedy. How not many football podcast hosts are also professional comedians. So how does that tie into the podcast? Do you think the experience that you get from doing that benefits you as a podcaster, as a broadcaster? How do the two things sort of intermingle?
I think so. I mean, I'm sort of self-taught in both, really. I did a comedy course 12 years ago, but that's like a sort of 6 weeks. I actually met my wife on that course, weirdly, which is a good good origin story there. People never expect that one.
I think that's something I've never heard, actually. Yeah. I've never heard someone say, oh, you know, how did you meet your partner on a comedy
course? We were very vulnerable with each other early days. We heard a lot of interesting things before we'd even gone on a date. But with the podcast, I'm pretty much self-taught. And to be honest, I think in terms of the sort of confidence of hosting, and I do a lot of MC work as well, I think the comedy has 100% helped that with that. Also, just the idea of... and this is my kind of ethos of broadcasting. It's the kind of let it go kind of theory and sort of go with the flow that if things go wrong in a comedy setting, you just have to go with it. And I think it's true with podcasting as well. And I've definitely relaxed in that kind of instance as well. And I think I've become a better host for it. But it's all just practice. I think broadcasting, performing, comedy, anything creative, writing it, it's all just practice. And I've obviously had 15 years and 500 episodes of practice, and I've done close to 1,000 gigs as well. So it's all just, but I think I also do think at the end of the day, I think I like the sound of my own voice, which I'm sure your listeners are probably getting right now as well. So I think, you know, doing comedy and podcasting is another vehicle for that as well. But it's funny, those two journeys have been pretty much intertwined since I started doing both.
I think it's a good thing. I don't think it would be too good an idea to go into a broadcasting or podcasting career if you don't like talking. but I guess it's something that we all struggle with, because on top of this podcast, I also do a podcast with my best friend about Warsaw, our team. And whenever I watch it back, because we do that in video, it's so... you have this horrible feeling of like, God, I'm talking way too much and I'm not letting him speak. And you just feel like, oh, shut up, stop talking so much. Do you ever have that problem? I guess you probably don't do a lot of editing nowadays, or maybe you do, but when you've been editing your own stuff, how hard is that to grapple with, that sort of, am I talking too much, too little? Am I talking in the wrong way? Do you have that kind of anxiety with it that a lot of people do?
Not anymore. I think I did at the start. And if I went back to listen to our first few episodes, in fact our first 50 or so, I've been lost to the ether. We used to upload them to SoundCloud back in the day, and they've gone. But I think if I listen now, I would certainly hear a sort of an anxiousness, and I remember being very anxious and very nervous, not necessarily about what I'm saying or how much I'm talking, but just I used to find getting the words out difficult sometimes. And now I don't have that, and maybe it's just from doing performing for so long.
I actually
watched back our video episode at the weekend and thought how good all three of us were. I'm not, but also the experiences of doing this means I think I do know when to stop talking and when not to. And hosting the podcast, so when the midweek pod with the three of us, one person will always anchor it. It's a different role to being a panelist, I think. And obviously right now I'm a panelist on yours and I'm able to sort of talk freely. When I'm hosting my episodes, I do make sure that I keep my chat to a minimum and I let them talk, and actually I sort of react to what they're saying and obviously set them up with my script rather than just talking. And I'm happy doing both, but really I think it's just come from experience. And also, if people are listening to your podcast and reacting favorably, then you must be doing something right. If you're getting, you know, hundreds of comments each week saying stop talking, you're talking too much, etc., then fine, you take that feedback on board and maybe you change the way you deliver it. But if people are enjoying the podcast, then you're doing something right, and so essentially the amount you're talking, what you're saying is probably about right.
That is a good point. To get back to the fan base, we talked about the positives of it. All fan bases have their toxicity, I think, and especially nowadays with social media. Can you remember any particular periods where if there has been any, where the toxicity has gotten a little bit out of control or a bit out of your taste at Selhurst Park or online?
At the ground, no. To be honest, there's been, I've probably seen 1,000 Palace games. A friend of mine actually linked me to an app recently. I can't remember what it's called, where you can put in every game you've seen ever. And he said I can't remember what it's called. It's called Memento or something.
I see it on Twitter. Yeah. I see people screenshot their things of that.
And you can put a photo in your at that game and stuff. And you can go all the way down to non-league. And I do go and watch my non-league team, Chesham United, who are on the cusp of promotion to National League South at the moment. And he spent 2 hours doing like half a season. So at some point, I'll take that on. But I must have seen 1,000 Palace games. In those 1,000 games, it's probably a handful of times that there's been crowd reactions I've not been happy with. I think generally, Palace fans get it right in person. Online is a different beast. And actually, I'd say, if I'm being totally honest, right now, or certainly in the last 6 months of Roy Hodgson's latest reign, is probably the most toxic I've seen online, to the point where I've actually stopped engaging with Palace Twitter at the moment. Because it's very, and I'm sure it's the same at every club, certainly online,
it
very
reactive. It definitely is. Even in League Two, it is.
It's very reactive. There's little, certainly straight after games, little context. There's little kind of like analysis. It's all like, I mean, it's literally, if we win, you know, we're going to Europe. If we lose, we're going down. Whereas obviously over the course of the season, we all know that doesn't work like that. I've actually stopped on my main account, my main sort of professional comedy account, I've stopped really engaging anything. Anything I would say on Palace you end up getting trolled. And it's not just me, all my mates the same, because there's just such a like a weird, it is a toxicity towards anything. I've actually created a new account just for fantasy football because I'm obsessed with FPL. I won't give out the handle because so far it's been untouched by trolls and no one's found it. And I'm able to say whatever I like. I'm actually able to put all my comedy content on there because, again, put my comedy stuff on the Jim Daly one. It gets trolled. There's so many Palace fans out there that aren't really a fan of what I do, which is fine. They're allowed to think that. But
they're not a fan of a take you had. Like, I don't know, you said give Hodgson a chance. And yeah.
Oh, well, I was... Yeah,
all your comedy is terrible. Everything you do is terrible.
Right. I mean, it might be that they don't like the comedy, and that's totally fine. But like, I do think there is a sort of weird tribalism that comes with that. And I was actively very pro Hodgson, and sort of still am. Although I do think it probably was about the right time when he left at this most recent stint. So yeah, it is. I think it's probably across social media, all fans. I think there's something post pandemic. I think something has happened to sort of social media that has made people a lot more angry, I think, with everything. Not, you know, see, with politics, Twitter as well, I think is the same. But Palace is certainly not immune to that at the moment. And it's not particularly, and to be honest, even with FYP, we are talking at the moment about dialing back our social, certainly on Twitter, our frequency, and just putting up podcast updates, questions, and leaving it at that, because anything we do on there is also attracting a certain amount of toxicity.
Well, let's talk about Hodgson, because as an outsider, that was such a tricky situation, because it's always hard when you see a manager that you think, yeah, probably it is the right time, and you could understand fans being a bit disgruntled. But then at the same time, you look back on the job that's been done over the years, over two stints, and you think, well, not that he deserves more time, but he deserves sort of, I don't know, to be treated well. And sometimes online, like you say, with Twitter, it doesn't represent the match-going fan base, but it's tough to watch sometimes. I mean, do you think when the dust has settled that Hodgson will be remembered fondly by most Palace fans?
I think he will. And there is actually a little bit of a sort of unofficial campaign at the moment to get him to come back to the last home game of the season and give him a sort of proper send-off. I don't know the man, but knowing of him, I actually don't know if that's what he want to do. I think he's actually quite a private person, just loves football. I'm lucky enough to interview him in November, and I really was sort of struck by the, and I don't mind, mean this to sound ageist at all. Obviously, he is the same age as my, he's actually 10 days older than my dad. My dad's very proud about that. Like, well, I'm younger than Hodgson, so at least give me that. But you can tell Hodgson's obsessed with football, and there's a real sort of passion that comes through when he's talking about the game. And I imagine that's the sort of passion that kept him in the Palace job, and it kept Steve Parrish, you know, keeping him in his hot seat. I think a lot of Palace fans online that were anti-Hodgson, I think, kind of forgot how old he was a little bit. And again, like, I'm not trying to turn this into an age debate, but the guy is 76. I think a lot of people said a lot of things online they would never say to a 76-year-old's face. I saw one particular Palace, will not name him, and I hope this isn't like, can get back to, what's the word I'm looking for, jigsaw identification, but one particular Palace podcaster went on a high-profile platform and said, there's so much respect for Hodgson from us, and we wish him the best. And literally 2 days before, he'd tweeted something like, sack him now, or like, sack him before kickoff or something. I was like, but again, it's just I think it's just lack of clarity sometimes, lack of self-awareness, and also
overdose of passion as well. People are so passionate.
Completely. And I get that. And I think sometimes maybe I lack a little bit of that passion. And I think also Hodgson was the sort of manager that when things are going well, it's really easy to highlight what he's doing well. When it's going badly, it's really easy to highlight what's not going well and what you think he's not doing well. So I can totally understand why people were frustrated with him. I still think that he's the best manager we've ever had. When you look at his record of keeping, no other manager has kept Palace in the top flight for 5 years. And I think you'll always be fairly secure with him. I think the new guy, Glasner, has done really well and a great start, and we're all hopeful. But, you know, we are all also tinged by previous managers who had good starts. And even Vieira had a great first season and then was gone halfway through this. And I really liked Vieira. And again, I got to interview him once, and look, he was incredibly impressive, charismatic to the, you know, to the hilt, and just a lovely bloke. And I really wanted him to do well. So we'll see what happens to the new guy. But I think you're right. Once the dust has settled, I think some people will look at Hodgson slightly differently to how they did. I think possibly slightly a bit, not embarrassment, but maybe sort of looking back and think, could I have been a bit kinder there? But
tiny bit of regret, maybe.
Maybe. I mean, maybe not. I know some people now who are still fervently like, yep, he was time to go and I never liked him, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fair enough. And I do, as a sort of staunch Hodgson fan, I do wonder if actually coming back this season, so last summer, probably wasn't maybe the right decision. And actually the club needed to maybe try something different. But I can see why they went for him. And actually fair play to him at 75 saying, yeah, I'll take it on. And Ray Lewington as well for giving it a go. It's a shame the way it ended, but I do think that he's the sort of person that either end of the season or next season, if he ever comes back as a guest, I think from 99% of Palace fans will get a huge welcome and appreciation for what he's done.
When you interviewed him, I'm sure it was obviously almost 100% Palace related, but did you get any Serie A tidbits out of him? Did you ask him anything about his time in Italy?
No, I didn't. I should have, because I remember him being Inter manager, and I think he had Ronaldo and Roberto Carlos, I think. Was around, and probably I'm guessing Javier Zanetti as well. No, I didn't ask him about
that.
And
this was way back in the day. So, I mean, you would have been a teenager probably then at the height of your fandom, I suppose, for Serie A.
Yeah. I'd have been 13, 14. Like, yeah, absolutely into it. And not far away from getting back into Palace, to be honest. And, you know, a couple of years later, I've got a season ticket and Palace are in administration and I'm in the homestead. And I'd transferred that passion into sort of my local team, which was good. But no, Hodgson was... lovely guy. He actually presented me, I'm in the wrong part of the house, I got it in the living room, a signed shirt with FYP 500 on the back that he'd signed, which was completely unexpected and really nice. And I've actually had it framed. Turns out framing shirts cost a lot of money. I did not know how expensive it was, but I thought it's the only shirt I'm ever going to frame. I got like the non-reflective glass and I got like multicolored. Oh, it was quite a lot, but it sits proudly in my living room now. And
it's so cool.
Every time I look at it, I always think how lucky I was to have that moment. And the fact that he gave us an hour and a half of his time, you know, busy guy, didn't have to do it. The only tidbit I got was he was not, I hope I can say this, we just played a recent game and he was not happy with the other coaching team's conduct on the touchline. They were a lot more shouty and in your face, and that's obviously not Hodgson's thing, and he hadn't quite enjoyed that, let's say that, which I guess is not a big surprise. It's not kind of the way he acts, but he was a bit grumbly about how that had gone. But no, other than that, very professional, no real kind of like too much football gossip, and they're very passionate about Palace and said some really nice things about the podcast and sort of our place in the Palace fandom, which was again unexpected and very appreciated.
Well, you've turned a page now, as you mentioned, Oliver Glasner's come in. So I guess to wrap up, what is the, if you did a sort of temperature test online and in the ground, how optimistic is the fan base about the rest of this season? And I guess what would represent a good end to the campaign? I mean, what could you hope happens in these final 10 games?
I think we have to be aiming for survival. I think we will. I think it's one of those seasons where the bottom two teams are so bad that it leaves one spot. And even that, I think, will be quite a low average score compared to previous seasons. I think I saw on Sky, it's like 34.7 points in theory is the average that would keep you up. So Palace only need a couple more wins, which I think they will get. They've looked a lot more attacking under Glasner. They're playing about 15 yards further up the pitch. The new signings, which admittedly came under Hodgson, Munoz and Wharton have settled really well. Munoz is offering us way more than we've had down the right in the last 5 years, really. There's definitely a sort of an air of, if not excitement, sort of maybe buoyancy back at Selhurst. It helped by playing Burnley in his first game, and Burnley were awful, absolutely terrible. Yes. So if we hadn't won that, I think, you know, there would have been question marks. Thankfully, we sort of easily we should have beaten Luton last weekend. And again, the old Palace problems are sort of focused in the last few minutes, crept in again. But I think we've seen enough. Even in the first 65, 60, 70 minutes against Tottenham, I think we lost that 3-1. But I think we could see there's enough happening in the team. I think we'll be okay. We'll probably end up 12th or 13th again. That's what we've done for the last 5 years, whatever it is. So that seems to be our home in the Premier League. I think the summer will be really interesting because we'll almost certainly lose Michael Olise, possibly Mark Gahey as well. So he'll have money to spend. Well, I say he will, Dougie Freeman, if he stays and doesn't go to Man United, will have money to spend. And they've shown recently they can reinvest that into up-and-coming talent. You know, Olise, Eze, Gahey, all these players that have played in the Championship and really transitioned to the Premier League really well. So I'm fairly confident they'll do that. I like the new guy. He seems really nice. He seems really passionate, knowledgeable. By all accounts, from what I've heard, the players really like him. And there's not that they didn't like Roy. I think a lot of them really liked Roy and wanted him to work out for him. But, you know, we are where we are. So everything seems positive, you know, barring sort of getting absolutely hammered or going on a horrendous run towards the end of the season, which I can't really see. Then I think we'll go into the summer with quite a lot of confidence about next season. And if we can get the transfers right this summer, then we could have a great, you know, it could be like Vieira's first season, and we could have a really lovely, fun time playing some attacking football higher up the pitch and scoring lots of goals, which has been a problem recently. So I'm fairly confident. I don't think, I'm not going to say the Dutch manager's name, the three-letter name that we had a couple of years ago that lasted four games. that name is banned. In South London, it's very different to that. Already you're getting a very different feel just in the way that this guy holds himself and talks about the game and you know, the way the players are responding to him. And also the options in the squad. He's playing a similar system, but he's got the players to play it now, whereas that previous manager didn't do that and was playing centre mids at centre back and left wingers at right wing back, and it was all over the place. So I think we'll be okay. But it's very early days to, you know, to say. He hasn't really had any sort of proper tests yet. He's got the same problems that Hodgson's had in terms of recruitment and, or less so recruitment, more squad depth and options off the bench. And it's interesting, actually, I've seen quite a few people online, certainly after the Luton game, making the same complaints about the manager they made about the previous manager. And it comes down again to options off the bench, really, when you're looking to see out games. And like for like, we don't have a like for like, you know, option for, say, Adam Wharton. We brought on Will Hughes, great player, very different, doesn't offer the same. Ahamada came on for IU in that forward number 10 position. Different player, doesn't offer the same. And it was quite refreshing to see the same fans moaning about Hodgson's issues actually moaning about the same. And it made me think, oh, maybe it wasn't quite personal. Maybe it was actually just down to situational. So yeah, he's got a task on, but I think he's had a good start, and that's been really important. So hopefully onwards and upwards with Glasner ball.
Yes.
No one's calling it that, I don't think.
No, but maybe this is the beginning.
Maybe we started something.
Well, fingers crossed that it'll be a good fit. Fingers crossed for the rest of the season for you. And hopefully, as you said, reinvesting in the summer, and we can see Palace sort of knocking around in the top half maybe next season with some luck. But nice. Jim, I'd like to thank you so, so much for coming on. Really, really appreciate it. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
You too, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Football Stories. It was such an absolute treat talking to Jim. We can't wait to bring you more chats with fans from across the footballing landscape, from commentators to fan group leaders and much more. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing. If you really liked it, please give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. That will help us out so much. Thanks again. Catch you next time on the Sporticos Football Stories podcast.
Sports Social Podcast Network.